Good morning, everybody. Hopefully, you guys enjoy the afternoon or morning tea. It's kind of a new thing. We don't do that in the U.S. So, I will start out by talking about C++ for new architectures. Now, this is a talk where I'm trying to merge together all the knowledge that we collected over the years of working on the console, Xbox 360, and Windows. And, merging this knowledge into the PS3, even though I haven't worked with the PS3, we know that the PowerPC CPU on the PS3 is the same as the Xbox 360 core CPU. Won't be talking about the SPU so much, but so much about the PowerPC and the architecture. How can you use C++ to take advantage of it? Most of the talk will be on performance and using C++ wisely. So today's topics will be some of these, what can we do to make games faster? A lot of games start out, you do lots of C++ classes, inheritance, you run the game, and it's running at 5 frames a second. I've seen many examples, and some of these things are small things we can do when we design the game from the get-go to make sure that we design it for the platform, design for the CPU, keeping these in mind. So, one of the topics, utilizing caches and memory well. This is very important in the next generation as CPU speeds are getting higher and memory latencies are also getting higher because the frequencies are not as fast as the CPUs. We'll talk about some of the C++ inefficiencies. This is what I say, use light C++. C++ can have some side effects where you're not careful with it. We'll talk about floating point math and what can we do to take the best advantage of it. Of course, the answer is not to use integer math everywhere. That is really old school. So we have to use floating point math, but we have to be also careful. We'll talk about branch prediction and where how that happens, things like unloading loops and performance pitfalls. Then 64-bit programming. 64-bit programming is everywhere. Obviously, the PowerPC CPUs on the Xbox 360 and the PS3 are 64-bit. The new x86, x64 CPUs are 64-bit. We have to be mindful and careful what are the pitfalls here in this area. And then, of course, a big topic of multi-threading, where the industry is going in that direction, and we need to be make sure that we take that in consideration when we design the game. And finally, in the same area of multithreading, there's OpenMP, which is sort of an easy, if you don't know what it is, it's an easy way of multithread the game. It can give you quite a bit of performance benefit if you use it wisely. So talk about console architectures today. What do they do well? Well, they're optimized to do floating point math really good. They have vector units to do floating point math, and they can do lots of these calculations a second. They have many cores. I mean, PlayStation 3 has lots of cores. Xbox 360 has 6 hardware threads. So they can do lots of parallel tests. Obviously, they're optimized to run games. There's very fast pipelines from memory to graphics memory, etc. But they're not really optimized for general-purpose code. And when I say general-purpose code, I mean code that is what I call really branchy. So AI would be, in my mind, general-purpose code. Database code and things like that is general-purpose code. So on that same topic, branch prediction. Not optimized extremely for branch prediction. Code reordering, it doesn't reorder your assembly code. And it doesn't do instruction pipelining or out-of-order logic. Now, the reason for this is, as we all probably know, is as we're trying to reduce the power and also make sure we can fit multiple CPUs on silicon. What we do have today with console CPUs is large L2 caches, relatively large. When they came out, 1 megabyte was considered large. Now it's 2 megabyte the standard, but it's still pretty large L2 caches. But on the flip side, we have large memory latencies. The memory speeds, the frequencies have not kept up with the CPU clock rates. And so that causes our latencies to be much higher. What are our challenges that we have to do? We need to make games on these consoles. We cannot just say, we just don't even worry about these CPUs and we'll just do our own thing. We've got to make the game. And the solution is not to use a standard language. Now, standard language has its merits. You can use them in tight loops, and that's very, very good. But that's not the solution to get the most out of the CPU. What we need to do is to make sure that we're clever and careful with C and C++. To make sure that we design our code and our engines from the get-go so that it will run efficiently on these CPUs. And also, the thing to remember is that C++, and I've seen it so many times, can break or make your game's performance. So we'll go into how to optimize memory access. So this is a key topic of what we have to keep in mind when we're accessing memory. I will often say is treat memory as if it was a hard drive. Treating memory as a hard drive is a good way because it is really a very slow, comparatively very slow. For example, 360, the CPU is running at 3.2 gigahertz. And the memory latency is 700 cycles at that frequency. So some of the recommendations that we have is never read from the same place twice or more than twice. Read data sequentially. Use single pass algorithms, and use everything that you read. We'll get into some more detail later of how we can make sure that this happens. So minimizing data passes. A lot of games have frame loops and etc. Algorithms that go through the data multiple times. This is really not optimal for next-gen hardware. Also, need to optimize the algorithms for a single pass. I know this can be difficult in some cases, but it will make a world of difference. And consider, we always say, consider less frequent operations. A lot of games calculate everything, every frame. A lot of times, this is not necessary. AI, physics, collision, even networking especially, particle systems don't need to be calculated every frame. They can be broken up over multiple frames and then calculated incrementally and partially per frame. We'll get into some detail here of some of the pitfalls of accessing memory on PowerPC CPUs. One of these is pointer aliasing. Now, pointer aliasing, if you don't know what it is when you have overlap buffers and you're trying to copy or process these buffers. Now, when you have overlap buffers, the CPUs are quite inefficient of handling these situations. I'm talking about the PowerPC CPU and Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3. What's happening here is that if you have overlap buffers, there's a lot of load hit stores will incur as you need to read a memory location and write it to the other one. So the solution, so the case here is that if you have the two pointers, you write anything from say B is 0 and you add 1 to B and then you write it to the next position of A. That's a great case. There's no aliasing. The worst case is this: is where you have an overlap pointer. You pass in A and address of A is pointing to the same memory. Now you have a problem of having to load from the same location, write it, and write it back to the same location. Now this incurs a very bad performance on these CPUs. The solution is to use the restrict keyword. And here's an example of how to use that. What this does is permits the compiler to do efficient code. The compiler will always try to do the correct code, so it's not gonna do it's not going to be bad code gen. But in this case, if you use restrict and the pointers in fact do overlap, it's going to have bad code gen. And that is because you actually told it that nothing overlaps. Now, what is there to restrict? Now, we shouldn't restrict everything, all pointers. So we should restrict function pointer parameters. That's a good idea. Local pointers, you can restrict those. And pointers to structs and classes. That's great. Should not restrict, for example, function return types, global pointers or global references. So, yeah, and if you restrict things and the pointers overlap again, it will generate buggy code. So moving on to the working set. Now, we need to be mindful of keeping the working set of data that you're working on small. So pack data that you commonly use together. This is, again, hot data versus cold data conversation on the caches. Make sure that when you access data, hot data that you access often is packed together. And keep all those data that you don't use separate. So, for example, I'll go on the next slide. A struct that has fields that you access too often and fields that you don't access at all is very inefficient. And consider bit fields. Bit fields are very efficient on PowerPC CPUs, and they do pack the data more tightly and give you better cache performance. And also consider better forms of lossless compression. There's many forms out there, Zlib, etc., that can gain you speed by compressing data and making it a working set smaller. Here's an example of an inefficient struct. Now imagine that you have this struct representing a car, and then you have a bunch of cars in your racing game, and you're going through a loop of checking and updating each car. Now when you're going through a loop, you might say, well, I need to make sure I check the manual bool field and some of the wheels and see if they're what speed they are. And maybe I'll check the max acceleration field. So what happens here? The struct is very sparse. You check one field in the loop, you say if manual do something, if wheels do something. But you see the file array there is probably not going to be used in every iteration. So what happens here is that you're checking these fields, it's going to be brought in the cache, and so we have a mixture of hot fields, of commonly used fields and struct, and cold fields. So that things that will be bringing the cache that will be overwritten by other areas, and so you will be incurring lots of cache misses in this case. A better struct is if you actually, have data that is more compacted together. You really need 8 wheels? No, there's only 4 wheels. And also, if you have to have more wheels, you just have a pointer to it. Also have a pointer to the area where the file name is kept. And also use bit fields for engine manual and etc. and convertible except Boolean flags. These will compress the data quite a bit and will give you much better L1 cache performance. So let's talk about C++ a little bit and containers. There's many containers that you can use in C++. They're very useful, very easy to use. But you have to be careful of choosing the right container. You got to be careful of choosing continuous containers. These are have the best cache coherency, like array, vector, DQ. And avoid node-based, linked-list-based containers, as they will have lots of cache misses if they're all over the memory. And if you use these, make sure that you use a custom allocator. So with this, you can allocate a memory block, so everything is somewhat memory coherent, rather than each allocation for each node. And just a note, vector standard store is often faster and smaller than lots of hash tables and things like that. Function call overhead can be a problem. Function call overhead has been a surprising performance problem for the Xbox One. But same true for the new PowerPC processors in Xbox 360 and PS3. There's many solutions. You can inline, you can play with compile options to inline any suitable. You can force inline some functions. But spend time making sure that you inline the right functions. Inlining too many functions can be bad, as it leads to code bloat and code cache overflow. But inlining not enough functions can also be that. So it's a delicate balance that you need to play with in optimization time. One of the things we saw as a performance problem in many games is virtual functions. Now, virtual functions are many people like them because it's a key element of C++. However, on a console CPUs, virtual functions do do incur some performance hits. So each virtual function, as you know, adds a branch instruction, needs to do a lookup. And unfortunately, on these CPUs, because how the branch predictor is designed, it's always mispredicted. So that, and the compiler doesn't know if the branch will be predicted or mispredicted, so the CPU will mispredict the branch. Now this incurs, you know, up to hundreds of cycles of latency when you call a virtual function. So consider replacing virtual functions with non-virtual functions with different classes, for example. Now, obviously, this cannot be done in most cases, but we've seen that for inner loops, this will give you a key performance increase. Leaf functions, by definition, don't call other functions. So if a leaf function potentially calls another function, it's not a leaf function. So it's much less likely to be inlined. And, you know, it must have an epilogue, prologue, and epilogue. And the prologue and epilogue on PowerPC is quite heavy. It's not like an x86. And it can lead to performance problems. Seen a lot of places where people put, you know, one or two lines of code in a single function, and that function is being called from an inner loop somewhere, and it really causes a performance problem because the epilogue and prologue really takes up more instructions than the actual function itself. So try to avoid these, inline these functions if you can, or merge them into the main function. This is an old performance trick, but it still applies today. Unroll the inner loops. You don't want to unroll too much. We found that unrolling to 4, like I plus equals 4, is a good starting point. And this is especially true on PowerPC CPUs because the branch instruction has quite a bit of latency. And don't forget to take invariants out of the loop also. The compiler won't always do this for you. As much as we hope and think that it will, it won't. So many times it's quite nice to have performance benefits from these. Now, talking about x86 processors, we often forget that native types are often 64 bits, or even one, larger, like a BMX vector is 128 bits. So when you have a BMX vector of 128 bits, many times you see games passing by pointer. That's not something that you should do, because if you pass a lot of value, it's passed on a register and it's much faster. Also, if you have a bit field that fits in less than 64 bits, you can go ahead and pass it by value, because it's going to be much faster. A little bit about data type performance. Often we think that small data types like char and shorts are faster because they take up less memory or whatever. But it's not the case. On these new processors, N32s and N64s are quite a bit faster. For example, Xbox 360, if you do an INT8 and N16 calculation, it's actually twice as slow as a 4-byte or 8-byte operation. So what we recommend, to not contradict myself, is that you have structs with compacted data fields and bit fields and etc. But when you actually do a lot of work on that data, you have local N32 or N64 variables that you cast that contain this data, and you do the calculations on N32 and N64 data instead of directly on the struct elements. So use native vector types. PowerPCs have the VMX units. Use them. They're quite a bit faster if you roll your own. For example, I don't know if you did this at school, but I did. It was very cool to have standard vector float fours and make a matrix out of it and just do it this way. This is not good code. This is going to be generating really slow code on these CPUs. That's right. You better believe it. I've seen it. I tested it. It's really slow. So use the dedicated vector registers. They're quite a bit faster, and they will be increasing your game sometimes tenfold in inner loops. What about your math buddies? So, vector fours on Xbox 360, we have an XM vector type of a vector four, an XM matrix. Now these are just meant for, we can easily use vectors and matrices. And there's lots of APIs that handle both of these vector types that are optimized specifically for a processor. And this is Xbox 360 specific, but there's similar construct on the PS3. The difference, as you may not know, on the PS3 there's 32 vector registers, and the Xbox 360 is 128, but they're the same. The same opcodes and operations are available, and you should use these as much as you can. On to branching, and floating point branching specifically. So floating point branches are very slow. And I'm not only talking about scalar floating point branches, but I'm talking about also vector floating point branches. So just because you're using a vector 4 and you do a branch on it, that doesn't mean it's any faster. So what to do with these? What happens is that the pipelines are flushed whenever a floating branch occurs. And it can be 10 times as slow as an in branch. So what we recommend is avoid loops and floating point branches, or find a way of doing an integer branch instead of a floating point branch. And that's not always possible, but it's something that you should really keep in mind. There's many ways of comparing integers, and one of the ways is of course, of taking the integer representation of floating point numbers, and I've seen code that, you know, being sped up, you know, tens of times by using this. Now, we have an instruction on these processors called F-cell. Now, if you use F-cell, it's an easy way to get rid of a floating point branch, and you get 10 or 20x performance gain in inner loops. So, F-cell option is, here's a pseudo or the code for it that says exactly what it is, just in case you have a PC compatible game or things like that. And you can easily replace one-line, single-line branch expressions, even multi-line branch expressions with F-cell. Now remember that you can floating-point calculations on these CPUs are quite fast. So even if you have to calculate things out more often, and avoiding a branch, it's often better. So don't think about saving calculations. Think about saving branches. So prefer platform-specific functions. The C runtime is not a best option, not usually the best option for performance. So for example, the fopen call, not the best performance call to use. For 360, use create file. Windows, use create file. And these calls, for example, they offer asynchronous modes, overlap modes, they return meaningful error codes, etc., that are much more powerful than the C runtime calls. Now, the next question is, we have XMem copy that actually does much faster memory copies, prefer that, you know, to use that. XMem set also is 8 to 14 times faster to setting memory, especially when you're setting all to zeros. And one of the gotchas of XMem copy on Xbox 360 is that it can't be applied to texture non-cacheable memory. This is memory that is used by the GPU for textures, and have to be careful with that. So beware of constructors. Constructors are very nice. They're very good. They do things like magic, but they can also, you know, generate lots of code and cause lots of performance problems. They're often dominating execution time. Why? Because a lot of people just initialize everything in constructors, and all these initializations are being called all over the place. So, you know, you can't even think about it. You can think about all the places of inner loops and etc. where you declare a variable, boom, a constructor is being called. So one of the things to do, don't clear needlessly in
instructors, just clear what you need to clear, or preferably don't do anything, or just set a bidding instructor if you need to. Just do the minimal that you possibly can as an instructor. And also consider inlining small constructors. This is actually a good practice, inline them. If they're pretty small, they're not going to bloat the code too much, and it's going to save you some performance. Memory allocation is another area that we need to get into, as memory allocation routines are often slow. They're very generic and they're meant to be allocating different chunks of memory, different sizes. They don't want to fragment the memory, so they do a lot of calculations and they're often very slow. So rule of thumb is do not do allocation in the frame loop. This is sometimes unavoidable. What can you do? Well, understand what functions allocate. Make sure that you can maybe call them less often. Consider writing your own allocators. That's very good if you have a fixed allocation size or you know precisely your data structures can be faster. If you write your own general purpose allocator, it may or may not be any faster than the built allocator. So that's not going to save you much time. And on Xbox 360, you can hook XMEMP alloc to you. If you want to do your own allocator, you can have your own allocator algorithm in XMEMP alloc, and by default call the original one. So it's real easy to add your own for specific cases. On to exception handling. Well, the whole takeaway from this slide is that be really careful with it. In fact, try not to use it at all. So, exception handling, why is it so bad? So, normally, the overall perf is only 1 to 5%. The problem is that some code tends to use exception handling as part of the normal program flow. Now, this is really bad. For example, if you use exception handling when opening the file, and if the file is not found or some error condition occurs, you execute a different code path. So now you're relying on exception handling as your normal program flow, which when exception is being thrown, it could be millions of cycles, which is that's really bad. So we recommend disabling C++ exception handling and recommend only enabling it for debug builds or builds that you make sure that development time builds. And also a gotcha here is that Xbox 360 exception handling currently could cause some corruption of data and even worse performance problems. So this is something we're working on now, but it's one more reason not to use at least on Xbox 360 exception handling. But even on Windows it's and on PS3 it can be performance. So, let's talk about some hidden C++ inefficiencies. Here's just an example of a few. C++ rocks the house. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. In fact, I'm Hungarian, and a Hungarian guy got to know with C++. I'm very proud of my whole thing here. But we have to be careful with it. So, C++, if you don't use it correctly, can bring your game to your knees. So, consider some of these code snippets. So, for example, quaternion queue, you have a constructor that may or may not take, thousands of cycles. So here we have a pushback that says, well, in this case, we're allocating memory, which is bad to begin with, and then we have a copy constructor, which could be really bad. Interflow conversion can be on PowerPC CPUs, interflow conversions, they go out to memory. There's no such thing as converting within registers. And so this naturally will incur a load store. And load store, as I explained before, is where you load from a memory and the CPU needs to wait for it to load the data before it can store it. So a load and a store sequence is actually naturally will be stalled longer. Virtual functions, again, as I mentioned before, they always will generate the branch mispredict and will cause you cycles. Here we initialize a game object, for example, thousands of constructors, each of them zero out, you know, maybe 100 bytes or 200 bytes or even more data. That's a lot of cycles wasted on just allocating that array. Here we have an operator overload for plus, and now we have to create temporary objects to make this operation work. Again, I++ temporary objects. What is the solution? Plus I. That will be much faster. The pre increment. So on to 64-bit programming. Now, as I said, most of these, all the parties of CPU are 64-bit, but this slide is also refers to the x86 64-bit processors. Many of us have gotten used to the 32-bit programming and gotten used to that point without 32-bit, everything's 32-bit, everything is fine and peachy, but not anymore. So long, point of long and long variables are not, the size of are not equal. And so that could lead to bad address calculations and bad pointer arithmetic in general. Here's some evil code examples. And you can probably figure out why they're so evil. As that they make an assumption about pointer sizes and data alignment on structs, which change dramatically in 64-bit environments. What to do in 64-bit? So avoid assumptions about pointer sizes. Make sure you use end pointer, uon pointer, and size underscore t pointer density to make if you do arithmetic on pointers. And avoid assumptions about struct layout or padding. Padding will be different on 64-bit, especially when you use pointers in structs. And so make sure that you either specifically say what the padding is for a struct, or avoid assuming that it's a certain padding. And make sure you compile with the highest warning levels. Often the compiler will warn you about truncation and conversion warnings that help these 64-bit issues go away. And last but not least, use native 8-byte alignment on these processors to avoid perf consequences. The 64-bit processors are even more sensitive to misaligned data than the 32-bit processors were. And this goes for x86-based 64-bit processors too. So onto the topic of multithreading. Why is this? Why do you need to multithread? Well, why? Because every CPU nowadays has 3, 6, 8 cores, and pretty soon I've seen CPUs out there for 64 cores, and it's not too far away to think that we can have a game console or a PC with 64 cores, and you have to write a game that somehow takes advantage of all these cores, or at least most of them. And Intel put out an estimate that more than 70% of the CPUs will be multi-core. I mean, they're coming out the quad core pretty soon here. But if you ever looked at Amdahl's law, and if you're familiar with it, it tells us that we cannot get linear performance. So just because we increase the number of cores by 16, it doesn't mean our code is going to run 16 times faster. In fact, it's not even close in most situations. But if we design our multi-core, multi-threaded game from the get-go for multi-threading, we can get quite close. So as I mentioned, good design is critical. Multi-threading on the fly could lead to even slower code than if you didn't multi-thread. As the CPUs are being stalled and waiting for other threads and deadlocks and weird bugs start popping up, that can be more of a nightmare to do multi-threading as a last add-on rather than a design. Here's an illustration of bad multithreading. So we start with thread one. This is your main loop thread in your game, and maybe you initialize some game structs, game objects, and you say, well, I'm going to create two more threads. Maybe I'll do some other tasks on them later on. And then those threads may create two more other threads that do some audio or networking or physics or whatever on them. And then you say, well, I need to update some objects, I need to draw something, so I'll put some synchronization points in there between the threads, and then later I'll put some more synchronization points as I find out that the game crashed a couple of places. So I'll put some more points in there. And pretty soon I'll put some more points because it crashed some more, and I had some more multi-threading bugs and deadlocks and things like that. So I'll put some more synchronization points. And pretty soon we have a cluster here of this. Each CPU, each thread is basically spending a lot of idle time. Now, these idle times are, you know, often and very small, but they add up. So in this case, each CPU may only utilize 50% of the time. Now, this is really bad multithreading. This is a design where you didn't think about multithreading at the design time, but you thought about it after the fact, when the code was written and it was just an add-on to speed it up. And often, this kind of thing just slows things down. Now, one example of good multithreading, and this is not the only way of doing it, this is just one possible example, is to start out with one thread and say, well, let me divide the game up logically to a game update thread and a rendering thread. This is quite popular. And then I just do synchronization points for each frame at the frame beginning and frame end, and make sure I don't synchronize on random places during the frame. And then during the game rendering thread, I may have multiple threads for physics or particle objects. I'll just synchronize those only. So rendering thread may have particles and animation and skinning. These are operations that can be easily multi-threaded, and you can use OpenMP, which I'll talk a little later, to accomplish these. And then what I have to do is that tasks such as networking and file I/O can really go up to a separate thread, and really they can be separate from the game loop and the game logistics thread. So this sort of scenario is used in quite a few games today on Xbox 360 that use all three or six cores on them, and it's been actually pretty successful. Now, there's many other multi-threading techniques out there. There's the job queue or job scheduling schemes. Those have to be managed also very closely, because they can lead to very long random idle times if the two threads, two jobs, don't come back to the same point at the same time. So again, synchronization points in this case are only at the frame boundaries, and that's a very good practice to not synchronize, you know, thousands of times in the frame, but just once or twice during each frame. What about design trade-off? So I've presented a bad multithreading and a good multithreading example. So there is obviously a sweet spot with everything else. So not enough synchronization when you just try to do everything locked through without synchronization and threads running in parallel can lead to very, very fatal, hard-to-find bugs, as data is not protected at all and can lead to deadlocks or very hard synchronization bugs. Too much synchronization, as in a bad multithreading example, leads to lots of CPU idle time. Now, you may not have any bugs because you got rid of the bugs by synchronizing everywhere. That's usually what happens. But now you have idle time. So what you need to do is, by design, just have right synchronization and to avoid a contention if possible. And then learn to look at data instead of program flow. So protect the data that you're using and organize logical data elements such that multiple threads can access those data elements without having to synchronize or with minimal synchronization, once a frame, for example. OpenMP is an industry standard extension to C++ that it's out of the box multi-threading. Well, it's quick and easy, and it can be used for some algorithms, but not for all. It can be used for many branchless or not so branchy algorithms. So don't try to use it for AI; it's going to be a real pain. But if you use it for particle systems, collision, sorting, animation, other physics algorithms, it can be quite beneficial. Any time where you have lots of iterations, for example, particles, etc., this can be beneficial. Some of the gotchas of OpenMP is that it uses many threads. It spawns many threads on your available cores that you have on the CPUs. So what this happens is that it may take up more CPU resources on all the CPUs. And the performance boost is small if you have small number of iterations. So OpenMP will not perform good if you have 10 particles going through and say OpenMP, because it needs to divide that board between 6 CPUs or 8 CPUs, and it will bog down in the process of dividing the board. It's really good when you have 100,000 particles, for example. Then you start to see the performance benefit. And one other point is that you can confine OpenMP to certain threads or cores to make sure that they don't use up your precious CPUs that may do very important threading tasks such as rendering or some physics or AI. So in summary, there is absolutely many things you can do to write efficient code on next-gen consoles. The thing that you need to remember is these points that I talked about, to keep this in mind as you write the code, as you design the engine, because that's the easiest way to get performant code. A lot of times performance is one of those things that is left at the last minute. We need to get the game up and running and get up and running. Well, that's great, but in the meantime, if you think just a little bit about performance and make sure that you write to a CPU the console CPU or PC CPU that you're designing for, can save you a lot of time later and a lot of time and can make the game really enjoyable. I mean, even today, games that run at 60 Hz versus 30 Hz, you can tell a difference. I mean, I enjoy a 60 Hz game quite a bit better than a 30 Hz game, especially a 30 Hz game that drops to 15 and spots. It's even worse. So, some of the takeaways is that treat memory as you would a hard disk. Memory nowadays on consoles, it has not kept up with CPU speeds, and it has quite a bit of higher latencies. And watch out for branches. Watch out for, especially for floating point branches, and use tricks like fcell. And prefer a light C++ touch. Make sure that the virtual functions that you use are not in inner loops or very, very tight inner loops. And make sure that you watch out and be mindful of constructors and such things. And when you think about multi-threading, thread your design, not your implementation. Do the threading design work at first, then write the code. So writing a single-threaded code and then trying to multi-thread on the go. And now I would like to open it up for some questions. If you have questions, we have a few minutes to talk about the clock. We started a little late, but there's some time for questions. Yes?
You mentioned that virtual functions are always used predictively on these consoles. Is the same go for the function pointers as well?
Function pointers are they don't involve a branch. So function pointer is just a function call, so there will not be anything mispredicted there. So yeah, no. You wouldn't incur a branch mispredict penalty. You have a question?
It's a bit out of topic.
Okay.
This C++ optimization, I was wondering about XLA, which you could work in C#. And I think, C++ is going to be much faster than what you could do with C#.
In some cases. So, not to go off topic, XNA is a initiative that we do at Microsoft, and it's really C# and managed code for enthusiasts and hobbyists. And what C++ is really, the stock of C++, and you can get obviously the best performance out of C++ on these consoles. C#, and you won't get the high performance, but it's really close, because C# compiles down to assembly language code in real time on these CPUs. It's not interpreted, and it can be real fast. And we own the compiler and the framework for C#, and that framework is extremely optimized for these processors. So while in C-sharp you don't have to worry about all these things, the framework underneath that we own and we develop is highly optimized for these processors. So the XNA development studio games are going to be running at pretty high performance. More questions? Yes?
No,
it's okay.
You do much the same stuff in C-sharp as what Gatsby probably does. Do they get solved by the people engineering CLR and then the physical form? Or do we still do that?
You don't have to worry so much about some of these things in C-sharp. A lot of these things are solved by the compilation and highly optimized coaching that comes out of that for Xbox 360. Now, some of these things also, you know, go to Windows. The Windows C-sharp environment is not as well optimized, you know, because it needs to be more generic and it's not game-oriented. So, but the Xbox 360 C-sharp environment is quite optimized. More questions? Yes?
Is the opening view that the
Actually, no, that's an industry standard C++ compiler support. We support Xbox 360, but I believe a lot of the compilers support it, especially on the PCs. I think Intel compiler, et cetera, some other compilers support it. I'm not sure if it's supported on Xbox or PS3 or other consoles, but it's an industry standard. It's an open standard, so.
Is that the base 2004?
Yes. More questions?
One
thread
program and
it
runs on
a
multi-threaded
process,
so
it will compile automatically, distribute it, and somehow connect
the
proposal. No, it won't. It's not black magic. But you can use OpenMP, that's kind of close to black magic. On sections of your single thread, you say you have a for loop of 1,000 particles or tens of thousands of particles, and say OpenMP this for loop. And will magically be distributed across the cores. But you got to be careful about OpenMP. As I said, is that you got to be have a pretty high iteration loop first. Okay, if there's no more questions, then thank you very much.